Hi, this is Audrey Michelle. I am pleased to present today Sam Vaknin. He is the author of Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited. He is one of the top experts in the world on narcissism. He's located in Macedonia, and he is the only expert that is a narcissist himself. Because he is a narcissist, his information is invaluable. He opens up the mind of an abuser. I came across Vaknin's work during my endless search and education from my own experience. My ex-husband is a narcissist, and I suffered through years of torture from his abuse. I never understood for sure whether or not it was my fault, what I had done wrong compared to what he had done wrong. He never admitted any fault, and I couldn't imagine that the situation that we had was normal. I have read 50 books probably on the subject and done so much research online. Vaknin's work stood out to me. His work is the first I read that comes from the mind of an abuser. I was able to enter the mind of my ex-husband to see why I fell victim to him, to figure out that yes, I was abused, and to understand the ways that he abused me, to learn why my reactions became the way they did, why my mind works the way it does now. There is so much information that he provides me that is so therapeutic. Anybody who is a victim, who has been a victim, who is an abuser, or has any interest in psychology or knows somebody that's in the situation will find this information invaluable. I am very, very thankful that I was able to get out of the situation, though I don't think I'm close to being healed from the effects of the abuse, and I'm fairly sure that I never will be completely. I want to help the people that are in that situation because I remember how hopeless and helpless it was. I don't think it's weak or strong. I think some people are just lucky enough to get out. I hope that this interview will provide information to victims of abuse as well as those like myself who are survivors of abuse. So without further ado, I present to you Sam Vaknin, and I have no doubt that you will be as amazed by what he has to say as I am. Thank you, Sam. It's very, very nice to have you, and I am honored that you chose to be a part of this interview.
Thank you for having me. I am equally honored and delighted. And thank you for all the nice things you've said. I have one overriding message. Get rid of your malignant optimism. Malignant optimism is the belief that love, compassion, and effort put into a relationship with a narcissist or a psychopath will end up transforming the narcissist and psychopath, the abuser. Well, it won't happen. It's wasted on the narcissist and on the psychopath, and it can even backfire. Get rid of your malignant optimism. Go out of the relationship. No contact policy. The best policy.
What if you have a child together and you can't avoid that contact?
Well, obviously, a child is only one example, but there are also couples with family-owned businesses and things that bind. The marriage lasted for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. Couples develop a panoply of things that bind them together. Children as business, friends, but living in the same city, working in the same company, there are chances for the narcissist and psychopath to turn the victim and to re-establish the relationship. There's no contact possible. Minimum contact if contact is inevitable. Minimum contact means the contact that is mandated by the system. Anything over and above the minimum contact is gratuitous. So if you talk to him over the phone when you don't need to, that's a violation of the no-contact policy. If you accept gifts, if you talk to third parties with the aim of reaching him, if you listen to third parties conveying messages from him, these are all gratuitous, unnecessary forms of contact, and they just perpetuate the abuse. This is the power of the abuser.
Same rules, basically, as what a court would put into play when you were having a no-contact order.
Yeah, it's called a restraining order. Impose a restraining order upon yourself rather than upon your abuser. And the police will take care of the abuser sometime. You take care of yourself as a victim. You impose a restraining order on yourself. Maintain distance. Refuse contact. Turn down gifts. Hang up the phone, etc., etc. The pillars of the community, they are actors. They have thespian skills. They know how to convert audiences to their cause. They know how to zombify everyone around them. And they use armies of friends, colleagues, neighbors in what I call abuse by proxy attacks. They use proxies to continue to torment and taunt the victim, or to draw the victim back into a relationship for whatever it's worth. So the best advice is no contact also with the social circle that you had with the abuser in common. I mean, it's difficult sometimes, but the wisest policy is to get the abuser out of your life together with everything you had in common, with the exception, of course, of children. If you had a house in common, try to sell it. If you had friends in common, say goodbye. If you work in the same place, resign. absolutely, unequivocally, and thoroughly. The only exception is, of course, children. You can't get rid of the children. But even there, you can try to reach custody arrangements which will minimize contact with the abuser. Even there.
So even though you're not supposed to talk to him, when your son's life and health are at stake, you have to try to have some conversation because you need to protect your child. And as soon as they get in there, they get that brainwashing back into your mind and you feel bad for them and the guilt comes in. So how do you handle the guilt that they have in your mind after 5 years? I still feel sorry for him and I still don't want to see him in a bad situation, don't want him to go to jail. As soon as he gets in there, when I couldn't talk to him for 3 months, I was much stronger, as was my son. As soon as he gets back in, there comes the guilt, mind manipulation again.
But that has nothing to do with him. That has everything to do with you. That is your problem, mental health problem or otherwise. The no contact policy or the minimal contact policy is intended to provide you with a time span within which you will modify yourself. You will take care of your vulnerabilities and chinks in the armor. If you don't make good use of this time and you essentially remain as you were, then it's your fault. You are guilty for that. You're not guilty, you know, if he goes to jail, it's the outcome of his own conduct, generally speaking. If the victim doesn't take care of herself, if she doesn't cope with her codependence, with her home conditioning in early childhood, which may have been abusive, with the fact that abuse is her comfort zone, that she seeks it actively, if she doesn't cope with her own pathologies in the time that no contact or minimal contact is maintained, then she has it coming. Of course, next time she will see him, her heart will throb and she will be at his feet. She has been conditioned. It's a Pavlovian reaction. You must deprogram yourself. Living with a narcissist or with a psychopath is the exact equivalent of being a member in a cult, a two-person cult. It's a shared psychosis. It's a psychotic state. It requires deprogramming. It's painful. You have to go cold turkey, and you have to do it under professional supervision.
I've been doing a lot of different things with abuse in my poetry and doing different interviews where I've talked about the topics of abuse through the poetry I've written. And one of the things that I get across is that abuse is addictive. How would they come into your life and they charm you and they make you feel like you're the most important thing in their life and you've saved them from something, and then slowly that disappears and you still are waiting for more and more of that affection, and the less it comes, the more you need it. And even though you're hitting rock bottom, you're still desperate for that small bit of all that they can give you. Do leave, you still in your heart still thrive for that kind of affection again of a narcissistic relationship. When I left him, I was at the weakest point of my life, had to block off all emotion, where he was telling my son, "Mom, left because she doesn't love us," and I could have my son hitting me, and for some reason I had to put up a wall where it couldn't affect me at that point.
First of all, you personally strike me as someone who is trying to successfully to cope with her predicament. You write poetry, you're conducting this interview, you're reading a lot, you are sharing with a pretty large network of people, you're helping people. These are all methods of coping, very good, efficient methods of coping. So you are not the typical example, unfortunately, because the vast majority of victims simply succumb to their condition. Codependent victims of abuse are very similar to alcoholics. Alcoholics, having gone through umpteen 12-step program, off the wagon and on the wagon, numerous times, they crave alcohol, crave the drink. The test is not whether you crave the drink, whether you crave your abuser, because you will be craving abusers, this abuser or future abusers, or more generally, you will be craving abuse for the rest of your life. You have been conditioned to crave abuse. It might also have a genetic component. No one knows at this stage. It's very similar to alcoholics and drug addicts. They crave drugs, they crave alcohol, you crave abuse. The question is not that, what do you do about the craving? How into positive things, like you do? And the vast majority of victims either don't have the tools to do that, or they are so depressive that they don't have the energy to go from negative to positive. They don't have the energy to convert.
You're so weak at that point. You're insane because you've been abused for so long, and you can go out somewhere and he seems, or her, I guess, in some situations, that they are put together. They act, you know, we have the best relationship, and here was the other person screaming, "No, we don't," in public. So you're the one that looks crazy and nobody can understand what's going on.
Absolutely. Nobody sees. There are quite a few authors, scholars, who noticed that victims appear to unkempt, harassed. Their nerves are frazzled. They give the appearance of nutcases, you know, wackos. And so victims are cast in the role of mentally unstable people because they're victims, because they look bad, you know, they look horrible. They've just undergone an ordeal. The abuser is composed. The abuser is well-dressed. His superficial charm works. You know, he knows how to manipulate people and the system. So the system is always biased against victims because it's very easy to look at a victim and say, look at her. I mean, she's completely crazy, this woman. So, and the abuser takes advantage of it. But I want to provide your listeners with an interesting insight, which is rarely mentioned in the literature, if at all, because it's not politically correct. Do you know why narcissists and psychopaths are very good at creating an addiction in their victims?
Because they can find your weaknesses.
Why do they possess this type of empathy, which I call it cold empathy, as opposed to warm empathy? It's the empathy of the reptile, the predator. They empathize with you, but only in order to ruin, because they have been victims of abuse as well.
Of course.
Narcissists and psychopaths are the only ones who really know what it means to be a victim of horrendous, long-term, uninterrupted abuse. This intimate knowledge of what it is to be a victim, they leverage it, and this is why they create resonance in victims. That is why when an abuser looks at you resonate. It's like you found your soul twin. The narcissist and psychopath is the soulmate of the victim. He is a malicious, vicious, but he is the black to the white. He is the yin to the yang. He is the mirror image of the victim because he is also has been a victim. This is the secret. My secret as an abuser, I have been horribly abused in the first 16 years of my life. And now I have all the weapons. I have all the knowledge it takes to home in on a victim and convey to her non-verbally, I am like you. We are two of a kind. We should stick together because we are two of a kind. This is what gives me the power to immediately, instantly create a shared psychosis within minutes sometimes. And henceforth, it's addictive. Why is it addictive? Because everyone wants to resonate. Everyone wants to find a soulmate. Everyone wants to be understood, to be recognized, to be accepted. And abusers offer this into the victim.
Now, I've read from you that there's different ways that people end up taking the abuse. Some become codependent and some become abusers themselves. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. These are the two strategies. Either you give in or you take over.
And the other part was that when you do leave, because some people never leave, I remember seeing my psychiatrist and we had a couple meetings with them because I finally got him to go to counseling. He wouldn't go, but the first two meetings were by ourselves. And he came home after a second meeting and he says to me, oh, she says I don't have to come back anymore because you're the one with the issues, which of course I knew wasn't true. And she said, no, I told him that he's a narcissist, that he's stuck in his ways, he's rigid, he's not going to change, so he doesn't need to come back. And that I can do for you is I can either teach you how to stay with him or teach you how to leave. And I said, I want to leave. Well, why don't you? I said, my parents won't let me. I said, but I want to. She said, how do I know when I'm ready? When you won't need their approval. And I remember thinking, that is never going to happen. And when I finally did leave, I would hang up the phone if my mom or my dad would put me down or something. I would say, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And as much as I never thought I'd be able to do that, I was able to. Like I said, I broke up all emotion. How does somebody ever leave and what's the breaking point? And how do you have the amazing strength in the world when you're at your weakest, most insane part of your life?
All victims live. The only distinction is between those who live in the physical, geographical sense and those who live only in the emotional sense. Vanish, wither under the narcissist's stare. The transition from one to the other is when the victim realizes, finally, that she had left. This is the critical moment. This is where most victims lack the necessary insight. They think that if they share the same apartment with the abuser, they still have a relationship going on. They don't realize that they have left long ago. But when he shouts at her, or batters her, or beat up on her, or humiliate her, subtly or not so subtly, she is no longer there. That's the main defense mechanism, denial, absence. She's not there. She's a shell. She has become a shell. And when the victim suddenly wakes up in the morning and says, wait a minute, I've left in years that we live in the same apartment, but I am no longer here. Alice doesn't live here anymore. I've left long ago, mentally. So why not just drag my body, you know, to rejoin in my mind? Left this place years ago. Why not reunite my body with my mind? And that's when the transition happens. But unfortunately, most victims don't reach this stage. They don't reach this stage, I would say, for three reasons, depending on the circumstances. There are those who are truly dependent on the abuser, financially, legally, professionally, and so on. The real dependences, real life dependence. There are those who have invested so much in the relationship at the beginning, and they are narcissistic themselves. The victims are mildly narcissistic, and so they can't admit to a mistake. they can't admit that all this investment has been in vain, mm-hmm. that they have erred. It's very difficult to accept that. So there's the second type. And then there's the third type, the depressive type. Depressive and addictive. Depression and addiction are close cousins.
Mm-hmm.
The depressive addictive type. And that type lies to herself. She creates a narrative, a confabulation, a fairy tale, in which the people, the abuser and she and her family and his family and common friends and so on, they all fulfill idealized roles. It's called imago in professional language. They all fulfill idealized roles which have nothing to do with reality. So her type of victim is no longer with us. She has deserted the planet. She lives in a complete, almost psychotic fantasy world. These are the three reasons why not to leave. Real life dependencies, fear of admitting a mistake, and the third type is those who retreat to fantasy world and they no longer face reality.
You keep thinking they're going to change. I knew that he was not going to change way before I left. But how does that fit into those three different places where people would stay because they really think they're going to change? Part of the three, does that fit into, or is that in all three of them?
No, a typical relationship with an abuser is a cycle, and the cycle obviously is divided to segments. So this malignant optimism is typical to the first and longest phase. 70% of a relationship is a consequence of malignant optimism. And then only the third type, the fantasizing type, the, as Kernberg called it, the borderline psychotic type, only this third type of victim, the victim that the other two types realize what's happening, but they are either truly dependent on the narcissist, they cannot leave, as I said, or they cannot admit to a mistake. So they realize that the narcissist cannot be changed. They can't admit that it was they who made the mistake. By the way, the second type of victim, the victim that has its own narcissistic issue in the relationship, it continues again and again and again, another attempt and another attempt and another attempt, just to prove herself right, chosen the right one. This kind of victim, once she leaves, she becomes a narcissistic abuser herself. She displays abusive narcissistic behavior, yeah, and she becomes an abuser herself. Can't generalize. It really depends on type of character, on the interaction between the two. So there's also a variety of abusers. Abusers which are pernicious, subtle, and stealth. I call them stealth abusers. They are insidious. And this kind of abuse takes ages. And very, very often, it's never perceived to be an abuse. Not by the victim and not by society. We have a phenomenon like gaslighting. In gaslighting, there is not a single overt act of abuse. The abuser is the epitome of the wonderful partner. Compassionate, he's caring. He remembers your birthday, buys you flowers, he is romantic. He's everything a woman can dream of. But he is an abuser. He uses gaslighting, or in more professional term, ambient abuse. He's abusing by subtly changing the environment so it becomes threatening. There is a famous movie, Gaslight. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
There's a husband there, and he's a wonder, this husband. But what he does is he plants all kinds of cues, all kinds of hints in the environment, and so he destabilizes mentally his wife by creating an ambience of threat, an ominous environment of innuendos and insinuations, ruins her gradually throughout the movie. It's a wonderful movie.
What's it called again?
Gaslight.
Gaslight, okay. I'll be seeing that this week.
Yeah, I strongly recommend it. So here's an example of an abuser who is actually, you can't pinpoint anything. He doesn't do anything. He is verbally courteous, he is physically, but you can't pinpoint anything. Yet still, he is abusive. There's a whole spectrum of abusers and a whole spectrum of victims. Sometimes victims are narcissistic, the abusers are psychopathic. It's very complex because human beings are complex. You can't 100% categorize or predict what they will do.
There's a couple things I wanted to get to. I wanted to talk about the people that do leave. Now, looking back, I always talk about how we're not victims. We choose to be there. We're accountable for our actions because nothing and no one can dominate a mind that does not surrender its control. And looking back, that's a very good view. But at the time, I never saw that. Do you agree that the person that's in the situation, yes, they might be a victim, but at the same time, they have accountability for being in the situation?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Being a victim is a very reassuring and comforting position. Especially for someone who has been a victim throughout her life, as a child and later on as an adolescent. Well, this is what I call the abuse comfort zone. Being a victim means surrendering responsibility. It means someone else makes the decisions for you. It's a very comforting situation. You don't have to decide anything. You don't have to torture your mind. That's why I call it a cult. What do you do in a cult? You surrender your decision-making power. And in return, you receive stability, security. Yes, abuse. But abuse is a stable phenomenon. Abuse is the most predictable thing in the world. Abusive relationship is far more stable and secure and predictable than a normal relationship. This is a give-and-take situation. It's a tango. You can't say that only one of the parties is involved. Only one of the parties is guilty. That's the abuser. But both parties collaborate. Abuse is a conspiracy, and both parties are conspirators. I know of only one and is really a victim, in the full sense of the word. Had she wanted to reassert control of her life, she could, even if she tried. And that is when you are married with a paranoid psychopath. A psychopath that is also murderous. There is a very, very tiny minority of sexual, sadistic, psychopathic predators. These people will murder you. They try to leave the relationship, they'll kill you. And they won't think twice about it. They won't blink. So these are really dangerous situations.
That's a psychopath. One of your types of narcissism is sadistic narcissism. That's what I thought, because mine was the sadistic. He actually gained pleasure rather than just not caring about your... He actually gained pleasure by hurting me. Now, is that psychopath...
That's not a sufficient condition. Sadistic narcissists gain pleasure, but if you leave them, they will find someone else to gain pleasure from.
Is a psychopath the same thing as a sadistic narcissist?
No. Some narcissists are sadistic. Sadism is a trait that is common to these two disorders and to many others. But there's only one type of abuser that is A, sadistic, B, psychopathic, in the sense that he regards people as objects, interchangeable objects, and has no perception of what it means to be human. It's a predator, sadistic, psychopathic, erotomania. Erotomaniac means that he misreads social and behavioral cues and interprets them within a narrative or a storyline that he has constructed. Whatever you do or don't do, he would read your actions and inaction in ways that suit him. Usually, he would interpret your actions and inactions as messages that you love him. A sadistic, paranoid, psychopathic erotomaniac is the only type of abuser where you as a victim, then you really don't have control. Then leaving might mean your life. The danger is serious. There have been numerous cases where abusers who fulfilled all these four demands have murdered their exes because they could not contemplate being abandoned or they wanted to punish them. There, as a victim, you're risking your life. But this type of abuser is 0.1% of the abuser population. They're very rare.
And there's different degrees of it. It's not black and white.
Yeah, absolutely. There are different degrees. It depends, for instance, how psychotic the abuser is, how delusional, and so on. So, really, there's no excuse. I agree with you. There's a book called Abuse is No Excuse, that the victim surrenders control over herself and her life willingly.
Now, what I was going to ask you about was the sexual relationship, only because I know that's a topic that's kind of a taboo thing to bring up, but I think out of everything I read of your work to me with realizations and brought back these memories that I'd forgot with tears. But there was one thing that I read. She talked about their sexual relationship, and I would assume this is more with the sadistic person because they actually gain pleasure, where sex with him was awful, and so we didn't have sex hardly at all. When we did, it was a very manipulative thing. During sex, I would be hysterically crying, I hate you, hurry up, and it turned him on. Is that a role of a sadistic? I want you to explain more about how narcissists would prefer masturbation, and secondly, how basically you're a masturbation tool. So can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. There's nothing tacky about sex. Sex is a very important dimension of life, and in some relationships, it's a critical dimension. So there's nothing tacky about it, and I thank you for raising these issues. It is impossible to have good sex with a narcissist, any narcissist.
They know how to do it well. And
they know the mechanics.
Yes.
It's impossible to have good sex with a narcissist because there are two types of narcissists. The cerebral narcissist is not interested in sex. He regards sex as a chore, which he reluctantly engages in 3-4 times a year in order to keep the partner somehow satisfied and in order to deny the partner the pretext of having an affair and in order to maintain the semblance of a relationship. So it's a chore, something to be done reluctantly, disgustedly, as infrequently as possible, and so on. That's because cerebral narcissists emphasize their intellect. I'm a cerebral narcissist. They emphasize their intelligence, but they also mean that sex means nothing to me. I lack empathy. They don't really know what it means to be human. Therefore, sex with a cerebral narcissist is a feeling of a chore. That's the way he treats it, and that's the way it comes off, and it's simply the most technical, cold, robotic thing. That's where the somatic narcissist is different. The somatic narcissist is a narcissist who leverages, uses his body, his sexuality, sex appeal, uses these to extract narcissistic supply. Now, inevitably, the somatic narcissist engages in a lot of sex. Sex is important to him. That's the tool, it's the instrument he uses to gain narcissistic supply. But he is more interested in the conquest, in the partner. He's more interested in his mechanical ability, his amazing range. It's more of a show-off, and you can't really be involved in a show-off with a partner. You have to be attuned to the partner. Sex is about merging to some extent, and the narcissist cannot merge because he does not recognize the existence of others. He does not recognize them. He's different, he's omnipotent, he's omniscient, he's divine, because he has no empathy. Even had he wanted to merge with another, he doesn't know what another means, so he has a problem of relating to other people. Sex with a somatic narcissist is even worse than sex with a cerebral narcissist, because you feel that you are a dildo, you are a vibrator, you are a masturbation tool.
A pump doll, that's what I called it.
Sex doll, a pump doll. You feel that you're a tool, nothing, you're an object, and uses you to gratify himself, masturbation.
It was worse than rape.
Well, actually, it is rape. No, the rape is objectified. The woman, he does what he does, he leaves. He's masked, he's violent, empowering. That's exactly sex with the somatic or cerebral narcissist. Don't misunderstand me. You may enjoy sex with the somatic narcissist. He's technically well-qualified and skilled in the acts of sex. But following the inevitable physical reaction, you will feel empty emotionally, mentally. It's like two people masturbating using each other's body.
And only one is enjoying it.
Well, no. Some women would enjoy it. Have you seen the movie Last Tango in Paris?
I have a lot of catching up on movies to do, it seems.
Right. Some women would enjoy anonymous. That's why women participate in group sex or swinger parties or whatever. It doesn't have to be sex addiction. Some people prefer faceless in impersonal sex, some people prefer personal sex. But if you are into real sex, multi-dimensional sex, where there is, of course, the physical, but also the psychological, the emotional, the background of the part, shared history, death, also future and past, also, if you are into a multi-dimensional display within the sexual act, then you are not going to get it from the cerebral or the somatic. But some narcissists are also sadistic, and especially sexually sadistic. That is the classical sadist. And they use sex to torture. As simple as that. The more feedback they get that they are succeeding in inflicting pain, the more aroused they get.
Whereas my example of me crying and screaming was exciting to him.
These are great arousal factors to a sadistic. All types of narcissists are autoerotic. Autoerotic in the sense that they are the object of their own sexual attraction. While normal people are attracted to each other, regardless of sex, some people are attracted to same sex, some people are attracted to the opposite sex, people normally are attracted to other people. The narcissist is attracted to himself. That is exactly the essence of narcissism, self-attraction. He is attracted to himself mentally, but also sexually and physically. This is something that very few therapists and people realize, that the narcissist is 100% autoerotic. He is the object of his own sexual attraction. There's very little he can do with himself except masturbation. In order to reach himself, he uses partners to mirror himself to himself. That is sex with the narcissist, mirroring. We find interesting narcissistic tendencies among homosexuals. This is not to say anything denigrating about homosexuals. I have nothing against or for. It's a sexual preference, and I respect it as I do any other. But among homosexuals, from my experience, I found strong narcissistic tendencies. And I think the reason is that the narcissist is in love with himself. He's sexually attracted to himself. And so he would prefer someone who would be like himself. A male would prefer a male, and a female would prefer a female, because that's the closest you get to having sex with a mirror image. Similarly, narcissists are overrepresented in incestuous relationships, because having sex with your daughter or your son, or having sex with a sibling, is as close as you get to having sex with yourself, genetically speaking. It's like having sex with 50% of yourself. And this is why narcissists are definitely, hugely overrepresented in incestuous relationships. Narcissists are overrepresented in also in cases of sexual serial killing.
There are people, as anything else, they're abused as children, and they can't control the thoughts in their mind. Now, the people that actually go ahead and commit rape or child molestation, are those the ones that have the psychopath or sadistic or narcissistic sides in comparison to the ones that think it or get therapy?
Well, I tend to rely on studies made and research. So at this stage, what we can say with certainty is this. There is an overrepresentation of people with narcissistic personalities personality disorder in incestuous relationships, especially with offspring. There is an overrepresentation of narcissists among serial killers. There is an overrepresentation of narcissists among sexual predators, especially sexually sadistic predators, people who kill while they have sex. And there is no conclusive data regarding the representation of narcissists among pedophiles and among other sexual paraphilia.
Because I know that sex addicts tend to put on a narcissistic facade as part of their double life, but you're saying that sex addiction and narcissism are basically completely separate.
Actually, cerebral narcissists are averse to sex, exactly the opposite of sex addiction. And somatic narcissists act as though they are sexually addicted. They are actually addicted to sex, but they are not addicted to sex for the same reason that the classical sex addict is. They are addicted to sex for other reasons. It's a power play. It's very close to rape in this sense.
Control.
Control, power. Rape is not a sexual act. Rape is an act of control.
Of course.
And it's the same with somatic narcissists. I would generalize and say that narcissists are not sex addicts, although from the outside, superficially, somatic narcissists appear to be sex addicts.
But it's not a compulsive behavior and that they have a high, it's more of control.
Yes, it's more about power and control, definitely.
The documentary you're in, it was called I, Psychopath. I definitely wouldn't consider you a psychopath. You seem to interchange the words. I know that they're very similar, but are they the same to you? How do you decipher between the two?
True diagnosis is antisocial personality disorder.
Right.
It's, of course, a personality disorder, very similar to narcissism.
Borderline personality disorder, is that similar too?
No. Borderline personality disorder is the closest we get to real mental illness. This is why it's called borderline. It's on the border between a personality disorder and psychosis.
They have narcissistic tendencies, though.
Yes.
Okay.
They have narcissistic traits. My personal belief is that all cluster B personality disorders are founded upon a pathology of healthy narcissism. There was a test in the movie, a psychological test called PCLR, Psychopathy Checklist Revised. The questionnaire was invented by Robert Hare. I have my reservations regarding this test, but the cutoff rate for psychopaths in this test is 30. You have to score 30 to qualify as a psychopath. And I scored 18. That means that I'm not a psychopath in the strict sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
But I have high psychopathic tendencies.
A narcissist would have, but they're not at that same level.
Yes, that's exactly it. The vast majority of narcissists have antisocial tendencies. Some of them sublimate these tendencies, so they become politicians. Some of them become rebels, rebel authors, filmmakers. It's also kind of antisocial, you know, flaunting the social norms and so on. Some of them become criminals, some of them, etc., etc. I think narcissism and psychopathy are closely intertwined disorders. Most narcissists are antisocial. Antisocials, all psychopaths are narcissistic. And indeed, the committee that is writing the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5 has decided to abolish this distinction. And in the DSM-5, that is about to be published in a few years, there will be no distinction between narcissists and psychopaths.
Wow.
A few personality disorders into one diagnostic category. And this reflects reality.
What
so the whole movie, I, Psychopath, is premised on very, very outdated information that's already been discarded by the majority of scholars in the field. Plus, technically, I'm not a psychopath, even by the movie standards.
No. We discussed it, but we never really went into it. Do you have any kind of explanation? At your weakest point in your life, you can become so strong. I was insane. I was at the weakest point of my life. And somehow, I don't even know how, some power came over me to do this, where I was completely absent from the world mentally in every way. I was one that left. Do you have any explanation of why that would happen?
Yeah, of course. Weakness is an illusion. There's no such thing as weakness. Weakness is the reaction to a sudden realization that everything you held dear, all your received wisdom, is worth nothing. Weakness is not a state of body or a state of mind. Weakness is a reaction. You react to letting go. Letting go is very painful and very overpowering. And your reaction to that is weakness. Normally, once you have let go of your baggage, the weakness vanishes and you are left only with your strength. Your strength is always there. It's never been depleted. It's never vanished. It's always there. You are unable to tap your strength because your strength was subjugated and suppressed by stories you told yourself, wrong advice, wrong narratives, fairy tales,
brainwashing.
Fantasies, brainwashing, all this simply buried your strength, but it did not eliminate it, nor did it deplete it. Getting rid of these archaeological layers provokes weakness. It's like a knee-jerk reaction, like going weak in the knees, but the weakness disappears with these layers. They go together. They're linked. Once you get rid of all these baggage, the weakness goes with it. And you were left only with your strength?
I wanted to make sure that you had time because I had a lot of people ask me how to get your book, and I sent them some of the articles. First, I wanted to know for you, you said that it's not curable. I know that they say the 98% is incurable. Now, I guess you were one of the 2%. You're not cured, but you're one of the 2% that realized what the issues of their life was. Does that make you one of the 2%? And if so, what happens to an individual? From what I heard, they have to lose absolutely everything.
Yeah, you have to hit rock bottom in order to become self-aware and accept that you're a narcissist and therefore you are the fount or the source of everything bad that's happened to you. But as I told you in our previous conversation, knowledge is not the same as emotional insight. In the absence of emotional insight, no transformation happens. So knowing is not the same as being transformed. Narcissism cannot be cured and cannot be healed. Not 1%, not 0.1%. Not a single narcissist, if he is truly a narcissist, if he has truly been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, which is the extreme end of the spectrum. These people, I among them, are incurable. What could be done for them or with them to modify their behaviors so that their conduct becomes socially acceptable or in extreme cases even socially condoned? And this is what I did with myself. I have channeled my addiction to narcissistic supply, my need to exploit people, my lack of empathy and so on. I have packaged them, all these negative traits, and I have channeled them into something that largely is considered socially acceptable. Write books, giving interviews, corresponding with people, and these are socially acceptable behaviors. I could have as easily taken these negative traits and I could have channeled them into something which is not socially acceptable, for instance, crime. But I chose writing books over crime.
Well, that's because you're a cerebral narcissist. So basically, it's not so much that you seek, that you feel empathy for victims. It's that your wisdom can help them is because you're a cerebral narcissist. So basically, you're giving that wisdom because that's your narcissistic supply more so than actually empathy.
It caters to my narcissistic supply. It puts money in my pocket. It attracts attention. It caters to my narcissism on a multiple limit.
But it doesn't. It's not really empathy for the victim in a way.
No, there's no empathy for the victims at all.
You're so honest. I love it.
There is very deep knowledge about victims and their psychodynamics and about abusers and their psychodynamics. You know, there are many victims online that say, Sam Vaknin is a narcissist. There is nothing I can learn from him.
I had to answer someone, but they said, why do I want to see from the other side? The point is that you can see it. If I knew the information that Sam had prior to my experience, maybe that would have showed me ahead of time what was going on. And she actually came back and said, you're right. But she didn't even want to hear the explanation. She just saw seeing the abuser from their mind as, well, who cares what they have to say?
That's absolute idiocy.
It's ignorant.
It's ignorance. This is the outcome of stupidity. You have to be very, very stupid not to want to know what the abuser thinks, what he's planning, what his tools are, and so on. You're a victim. You're in a battle. And you say, I don't want to know the enemy. I don't care how many tanks the enemy has. I don't care what the enemy's plans are. I don't want to know anything about the enemy, and I don't want to talk to any spy coming from the enemy's camp. And that's bizarre. That's not very wise.
It's just a stereotype, and you know, any stereotype, I think, is ignorance. We have so much more to talk about, obviously, but I want to give you the chance to talk about when you realized you were in jail, wrote this book, and I want you to tell people about the book, because there's so many articles online. Is that what's in your book, or how does that separate, and where can they get your book, and what can they expect to learn from Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited? What can they expect to gather from that?
There is a total of 10 books. One of them is a print book, and 9 are electronic books. They are roughly divided 6-4. 6 of the books, including Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited, the print edition and the electronic edition, 6 of the 10, I compare them to user manuals. If you buy a computer, you have a user manual. You buy a car, you have a user manual. You get married to a narcissist, I wrote the user manual. You get married to a psychopath, I wrote the user manual. You won't buy a car without a user manual, but you would get married to an abuser and not buy my books, which are the user manuals of abusers. So how they're built, how they operate, how you can dismantle them, how you can counter them.
So basically, whether you're planning to stay or leave, this is going to help you out in either manner.
Yeah, the user manual, I don't glorify the books. I mean, they're not masterpieces. They are simple, down-to-earth user manuals.
Right.
Enter the abuser's mind, and you want to manipulate the abuser to prevent abuse, and you want to have the upper hand, you should buy my books because they are user manuals. And the other 4 are advice given to victims on how to cope with abusers and how to cope in situations of abuse. So That's how I would define my work.
Now, I know it's important to talk about the fact that you're not a psychiatrist, but they're written in a whole different level, because I've read a ton of books by psychiatrists, but yours are real life experiences that people can really relate to, whereas psychiatrists, whether they be narcissists or not, they're talking about facts, they're talking about the DSM, they're talking about things that are educated through books, whereas your information is tangible.
My work has been quoted in 1,100 scholarly articles and in 4,300 books, many of them written by scholars and psychiatrists. So my advantage over psychiatrists and therapists, an advantage that is recognized by them, that's why they're quoting me, is that I am the one in the sense that I am a narcissist. It's different to write about narcissism by serving narcissists. I'm a whistleblower narcissist. I blow the whistle on narcissists. I can tell you with absolute certainty, no mental health practitioner or professional, and not a single one of them, has any real grasp of narcissism. And the reason is that very few narcissists go to therapy. And when they do go to therapy, they never open up. And if they do open up, it's only to play mind games and power play.
Of course.
Therapists, psychologists, researchers, and scholars have no access to narcissists and to their mind. Period. So whatever they write is wrong. The vast majority of things I've read about narcissism in scholarly publications and in textbooks are absolutely off the mark. The researchers and scholars and so on, they actually are being abused by their narcissistic patients. They're being manipulated by them. Narcissists are great actors, great manipulators. They never give you access to their mind. They always have an agenda. They never tell the truth. They never empathize. Nothing. It's an iron curtain. I come from the battle. I am a narcissist. I'm the first ever narcissist to have opened myself up with 100% brutal honesty. I don't mean swords, you may have noticed.
No, I love it.
So I think both victims and professionals, mental health professionals, would do well to pay attention. Not because I'm such a genius or so grandiose or a masterpiece or whatever. None of this. Simply because it's the first ever first-hand account of narcissism. There has never before been a first-hand account of narcissism. Mm-hmm. Simple as that.
So basically, where they don't open their mind to you, you are the opposite of that. You have opened your mind to everybody, where narcissists always do not do that.
And because I am a narcissist, I have corresponded with hundreds of narcissists who felt that they are my soulmates. So I've had access to the minds of hundreds of narcissists and psychopaths. I have also corresponded with tens of thousands of victims, friends, family members, and so on. I have 20,000 members on my mailing list, and I used to have 40,000 until MSN closed down its website. So my work is not only a first-hand account, which is invaluable in itself, but also the summation and crystallization of 15 years of correspondence with tens of thousands of people, including 1,000 therapists who are members of my list, including 700 narcissists, people diagnosed, who are members of my list, in well over 20,000 victims. I think it counts for something.
Oh, it counts for a lot, and I think you're going to, through our interviews, gain a lot more notice, because there's already, I think, 200 people, literally, that have contacted me about the interview. It's funny, because in the primary interview, when I couldn't get the Skype to work through the blog talk, I was trying to get people, I'm like, Mom, call in! Initial shock. There's so many people that are listening to the archives and so interested in it. They're excited for this and for our next blog talk interview, because there was so much recognition just from that I can't even imagine what is going to come of this or the next blog talk that we're going to do within a week or two.
At your disposal. Whenever you want, I'm here.
And me too, because I can never get enough. I could go on for hours with questions. And as much as you explain, I want you to explain to all these people, because it was so gratifying to me to understand myself, to understand him, and to my huge thing in life is to help people in the situation I was in, because I know how helpless it feels. I would feel like either he or I had to die to get out of it. So in every manner of what I seek in life as a codependent, be helping people, you are an invaluable source. So thank you very much for what you provide, whether it's selfish or not. And I will be talking to you soon. Is there anything you wanted to say before we hang up?
No, I think we've covered quite a lot of ground, and let's leave something for the show itself.
I cannot wait. Thank you so much. It was very nice talking to you, Sam. Have a wonderful day or night, whatever it is over there.
It's night. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.